From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On this week's show, the federal government has developed a new system of warning people in emergencies.
I knew something was wrong. I was in a restaurant. Everybody's cell phone started going off at the same time.
We go to a local farm where teenage boys are learning about entrepreneurship and visit a ceramics class that's trying to bring different parts of the community together.
When we all come over here, it's like our creativity comes alive.
Plus, meet a Kansas Cityan who's competing this weekend to be the best barista in the world.
If you go someplace and you get these big bubbles, it looks kind of like, we always call it shower foam. You know, it's, you just shampooed and it's got these big bubbles in it. That's not considered a good texture.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. Last week's massive tornado in Moore, Oklahoma, came almost exactly 2 years after another EF5 tornado ripped through Joplin, killing 161 people. Wednesday marked that anniversary, and the city was greeted with near-perfect weather. Thousands came out that day to honor the lives of those lost and reflect upon the continuing recovery effort. KSMU's Scott Harvey was there and has this report.
Just hours before the ceremony at Cunningham Park, Melinda Underwood is trimming her backyard lawn at the corner of 26th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue, a site that was within the path of destruction on May 22, 2011. It was about six blocks north, inside Underwood's then apartment complex, where she could have easily become the storm's 162nd victim.
We were sliding, and my youngest had her legs wrapped around my chest as my legs started to go up to be taken away, I guess. And she wouldn't let go, and it was the longest, I think, 6-7 minutes of my life.
Driving east from the park along 26th Street, there are several empty lots and few large developed trees, but there's also an assortment of newly constructed homes. In fact, officials say more than 80% of the 7,500 that were destroyed have been either rebuilt or are in the process of being rebuilt. And while city leaders have chosen not to mandate the construction of safe rooms in new homes, they have taken steps to improve a structure's stability, including requiring hurricane straps for roofs. For community members like Underwood, it's the work of city officials, as well as the many volunteers, that have helped move the recovery effort along as planned.
We had strangers from all over the world coming to help that didn't have to, but chose, you know, to be away from their families to come help us get it together and figure out where we needed to go forward, you know. So we're very blessed.
Absolutely wonderful. Couldn't have done it without all the volunteers.
The home of Adelaia Garrison's mother was destroyed in the 2011 tornado. She says the dedication shown by volunteers over the last 2 years has inspired her to lend time to the recovery effort that's just begun in Moore, Oklahoma. The twister that struck the Oklahoma City suburb Monday was not lost during Wednesday's ceremony in Joplin, where donations were being collected to benefit the city, and teams from Southwest Missouri had already been deployed to assist in the area.
Well, thank you, and good evening to everybody.
Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano, who earlier in the day toured the wreckage in Moore, spoke of resilience, which, along with the terms resolve and revitalization, made up the theme for Wednesday's event.
The entire Joplin community played an important role in the recovery process. For example, deciding to build more resilient schools outside of the floodplain, develop stronger standards for home construction, and develop shared facilities for use as storm shelters.
It was a ceremony that honored the dead, praised the hours upon hours of help, and expressed much optimism for the future. But folks in Tornado Alley are not oblivious to the risk they face each severe weather season. nor are they numb to the emotional element that comes when another community is devastated by a storm. Back at 26th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue, 2 years after she was nearly swept away by that EF5, Melinda Underwood and her children are working to balance their emotions while paying it forward.
It's hard for us to be happy sometimes when we're sitting here okay and we see what's going on in Oklahoma. You know, and they went through their closets yesterday, cleaned out all clothes and shoes and all that stuff, and that was the first thing they did, you know, and they were wanting to help in any way they can. So I don't know if we'll be able to make a trip down there or not, but they know what it feels like.
I'm Scott Harvey.
Two years ago, when the massive tornado hit Joplin, there was a lot of concern that people weren't listening to tornado sirens anymore. So just last weekend, when that first round of tornadic activity hit Oklahoma and Kansas, I was driving through Lyon County, and my cell phone made a strange beep and vibrated. I got this odd text message with an image of an exclamation point. It read, "Tornado warning in this area till 6 p.m. Take shelter now. Check local media." Now, I got back home okay, but I kept wondering who sent me that message. Joining us now over the phone from Silver Spring, Maryland, is the originator of that message, more or less, Susan Buchanan of the National Weather Service. Thanks for joining us on KC Currents.
Thank you for having me.
So why was there a need for this new cell phone warning system?
Well, we have this new system. It's a recognition that, you know, a lot of people are using mobile technologies these days. They're so popular. And people on the go need a way of accessing weather information. And so we implemented this new program to give them weather alerts on their cell phones.
And, of course, some people get that through apps or then there's the old school ways of knowing that there's an emergency going on, like hearing it on a radio or hearing tornado sirens, let's say, here in Kansas City. That's really relevant. Why was this service necessary?
Wireless emergency alerts are not intended to replace traditional ways of getting weather warnings. So people should still stay tuned to their local TV and radio and also have a NOAA weather radio in their home so they'll be alerted immediately when the National Weather Service issues a warning. But what wireless emergency alerts are intended to do is be a bell ringer. So if you're in your car or you're out at your child's soccer game, the wireless emergency alerts go off and they're sort of a bell ringer. They tell you, seek additional information. There's a threat nearby.
And did you have any information that people weren't heeding traditional tornado warnings like sirens? I know in Kansas City, people were thinking about that after the Joplin tornado.
What we found after Joplin when we did a service assessment there and we interviewed people in the area that was impacted by the Joplin tornado is that people tend to look for confirmation. After they receive additional word that there's a warning or there's a threat, they want some sort of secondary confirmation. So oftentimes they'll go outside and look around or they'll call a friend or a family member and see if they've also heard of the threat. What wireless emergency alerts do is they give you that either first or secondary alert that there's a warning, so people will be more inclined to seek shelter.
I wonder if the idea is, you know, you're in the middle of doing something. Is this important enough to disrupt what I'm doing to actually take shelter?
Well, the National Weather Service issues watches and warnings. You know, we have a whole suite of products that we put out to alert people of what's going on with the weather. But whenever a warning is issued, that really should prompt people to, first of all, take it very seriously, but then to take the appropriate action because there could be, you know, a threat out there that's, that could take their lives.
And when was this new system rolled out?
It started getting implemented last summer, and each wireless carrier implemented this different times of the year throughout the past year. And so whether or not you were able to get these warnings on your phone is dependent on when your wireless carrier rolled it out in your area.
Have all of the wireless carriers now picked it up and are putting out these alerts?
All of the major wireless carriers do offer this voluntarily, this service voluntarily to their customers, and many of the smaller wireless carriers do as well.
And just in the nuts and bolts, what does somebody see on their phone, and what's the back end? Like, how does it work?
So people who have already been in an area over the past year where they've had a warning for such things as tornadoes, flash floods, hurricanes, extreme winds, or blizzards may have already gotten these messages on their phones. And what they are is they'll hear a unique tone alert that's unique. They've nothing that they have programmed into their phone, so it'll really get their attention. And then a message will pop up on their screen. So it's not like normal apps where you have to go into your text messaging program to actually see it. It'll pop up automatically onto your screen. And it may say something like, a tornado warning in your area until 2 p.m., take shelter now. And so these messages are limited to 90 characters. So, you know, they're meant to be a bell ringer to say, there's a threat in your area, seek additional information, take shelter.
Now, this is not based on where you live or where your phone number is, but where you actually are at the moment.
The great thing about wireless emergency alerts is the signal is picked up by nearby cell towers. So no matter where you are with your phone, if there's a warning in that particular area, your phone will pick up the signal from the nearest cell tower, and it will alert you of a nearby threat. So this is not tied to your home zip code. It's tied to where you are in any given moment with your phone.
Now, what if the cell phone lines are all busy because maybe just in the aftermath of a severe weather event or some other kind of emergency, everybody's calling each other?
People who have ever been in an area where there has been a major disaster know that cell phone lines can get jammed. The great thing about wireless emergency alerts is the wireless carriers set it up to be outside of the normal system. So these messages will not be prone to system jams, and you'll get the alerts regardless.
What kind of emergency will prompt you at the National Weather Service to send a message?
Over wireless emergency alerts, the public may get three different types of messages. They may get amber alerts if locally a child is missing. They may get presidential messages in the case of a national emergency. And the third type is imminent threat. An imminent threat covers weather emergencies. And other types of imminent threats may be a local chemical spill that you know, people may want to avoid a local area where there's a chemical spill, a local hostage situation, that sort of thing. So our role in it is to provide the weather warnings. And within that category, we will be providing warnings for tornadoes, flash floods, hurricanes, extreme wind, blizzards, ice storms, tsunamis, and dust storms. And there has been some discussion about severe thunderstorm warnings because lightning is very dangerous and deadly. But unfortunately, you know, thunderstorms can pop up, and they're very prevalent in the spring and summer in many locations in the country. So we just thought it would, we would set off too many warnings on people's phones initially if we put thunderstorm warnings out. So for now, thunderstorm warnings are not part of the system, but they're exploring ways in which to get thunderstorm warning information to people over cell phones. But that also speaks to why people need to not just use wireless emergency alerts on their cell phone as their only way to get weather information.
And I would think that you wouldn't want to send out too many messages so people just start getting used to them.
That's correct. Not just getting used to them, also ignoring them. We want people, when they get word that there's a warning for their area, we want people to take that very seriously.
I think that that may be part of the reason why I was surprised by it, because I had never gotten one before.
Yes, you know, it is a new system, so it's only been in effect, at the most for a year for certain people, depending on when their wireless carriers started providing it. So as people are starting to get these, they'll start to get used to them, at least be comfortable with what they are and know that they should trust it and take shelter if they get one of these warnings.
Now, do you have to have a certain type of phone or cell service in order to get these messages?
Well, all newer phone models will have wireless emergency alert capability. And most people who have cell phones will have the capability, but there are some older phones still in circulation that don't have the technology to receive wireless emergency alerts. And if people have questions about whether their phone has this capability, they should check with their wireless carrier.
Now, I have to ask you about last Monday's tragic tornado in Oklahoma. Do you know if there was time for a message to go out for that one?
Yes. The National Weather Service issued tornado warnings 16 minutes in advance for some areas, and some areas actually had 36-minute warning for the tornado last week. And so we did check with the wireless carriers, and they all did push our warnings out over the cell phones to their customers.
And have you heard anything about people getting that message and responding?
We do expect to start receiving feedback, anecdotal feedback from people, because we do after every major event, but we have not started getting that feedback yet. I think, the area that was impacted in Oklahoma, they're still in search and rescue recovery mode, and so I think it'll take some time before we start getting that feedback.
And what kind of response are you getting in general to the system and people letting you know whether or not this has been useful to them?
Well, we've gotten some funny feedback, and we've gotten some very serious feedback. People, by and large, are sending us emails thanking us for the warning, saying that, they sought shelter or they decided not to, travel on the road in an instance up in New York recently where there was a flash flood warning and, turned into be a very dangerous situation. Some of the funny feedback we've gotten is, someone emailing and saying, well, I knew something was wrong. I was in a restaurant. Everybody's cell phone started going off at the same time, and you just saw everybody pick their phones up off the table at this tone alert that nobody had ever heard before, and that was kind of interesting. But that's what it was. There was a threat in their area, and everybody got the message at the same time.
Huh, that's funny. It must have been a topic of conversation there.
Right.
I have to say, I was a little unclear on who was sending me the message, although the alert was signed NWS. Are other people wondering who's sending these messages?
I think it will take some time for people to get used to wireless emergency alerts and to understand who's sending them and to have comfort that, these are legitimate, with any new service. But I think once people do start getting them and they say, oh, this is the National Weather Service, they'll pay attention and heed the caution that's included in the message.
Susan Buchanan is a spokesperson for the National Weather Service. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Visit a ceramics class for visually impaired students in Kansas City, Kansas. You're listening to KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
In this next story, we visit a new art space in downtown Kansas City, Kansas, that's trying to bring the community together. The Epic Arts Studio opened a year and a half ago and offers residents and local students the opportunity to dig their hands into the art of ceramics. Sylvia recently stopped by a class for students from the Kansas State School for the Blind.
In recent years, this cheery little storefront in Strawberry Hill housed a barbecue joint and then a Colombian restaurant. But now it's a neat studio with concrete floors, long tables and stools, and exposed brick walls lined with shelves. And what's cooking is clay.
Well, we'll just flip a couple of these over and then put the little rails up.
And then roll it up.
Then roll it out. Yeah, and if you can do a couple of them, then just cover it with plastic.
This studio is Steve Curtis's brainchild. He's asking 19-year-old Mitchell Emerson to knead and wrap up some clay to be used by the class later.
Yeah, you can roll out that one first. And you can help him, all right?
I don't know what I'm doing, but sure.
Six young people are here this afternoon from the School for the Blind. They're taking this class as part of the school's art club. 20-year-old Haley Linnell is examining the multi-toned glaze on the two halves of a giant walnut that she finished last week. She pulls out a slip of paper that goes between the halves, like a fortune cookie.
It'll set kind of like this.
Yeah.
We'll just slide it through, all the way through, because it's for a contest. The judges can pull it out and read the Braille.
And what does it say?
I predict you will go nuts for this nut.
The students here have varying levels of eyesight. Like, Haley can see some. But they all enjoy working with clay because it's a tactile art.
When we all come over here, it's like our creativity comes alive.
Steve, come look at my me.
Okay. Look at your me?
Yeah.
16-year-old Matt Mitchell has made a geometric sculpture out of the letters of his name. He's an enthusiastic artist, poet, and irrepressible joke teller.
What did the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup say to the M&Ms? I come in pieces.
Ha!
Matt says he particularly likes ceramics because the clay feels like an extension of himself.
I just get some clay and knock it around. I just squish it into a ball and it's, a clam.
Steve Curtis says he's inspired by the inventiveness of the kids here. He's a community organizer for Community Housing of Wyandotte County and a photographer. So besides learning ceramics, he said he had to learn to think differently to teach this class.
I've always thought in terms of tones and colors and things like that, and most of them don't relate to those issues very well, you know. So their question is more about texture, what things feel like, what they represent, maybe what they taste like. So you can talk about colors as being an orange, tastes like an orange, a lime tastes like a lime. And it's not a direct relation, but it's a story you start building. And over time, they kind of figure out what works for them, you know.
It took some creative thinking to imagine this studio. Community Housing owned the property, which had been vacant for 4 years. And Curtis had long been interested in promoting the arts in Wyandotte County.
It seems like the solution is always to put in some sort of a gallery or something, but that's not really what the kids need. And most of the parents don't really understand the gallery either. What is it all about?
He wanted something more participatory. It just so happened that the folks at Accessible Arts, who run arts programs at the School for the Blind, among other places, were looking for a place to store a kiln and pottery equipment that they couldn't use at the school anymore.
And I said, well, it sounds like you have enough to make this live. Why don't we try to make it live for the kids in the neighborhood? And the whole idea is accessibility to kids, particularly kids with disabilities, but also to seniors, to adults, and to kids with economically at risk and different backgrounds like that.
Community Housing initially offered the property rent-free. The nonprofit Greater Kansas City List kicked in a few $1,000s to pay utilities, and dozens of volunteers stripped off inches of grease and renovated the space with practically no budget. Besides this class for visually impaired students, the studio offers classes to other local schools, as well as seniors, teenagers, and other community members. And occasionally, all these folks get to know each other, according to Aaron Kelly, activities coordinator for the Kansas State School for the Blind.
A few times when we've been here, there's been other kids from the community in, so it gives them the chance to meet new people, make new friends.
Let me see one of your hands, Marcus. Okay. Yeah, keep it in a fist. Good.
Matt Mitchell has been taking this class since the fall, but his classmate Marcus Sleep just started. So Matt helps Marcus make a punch pot, molding the clay around his fist.
Okay, so now, once we get it kind of soft, what you do is you want to flatten it just a little bit. So kind of Yeah, with your fist or with, like, the palm of your hand. That looks really good. You want to see what Steve thinks of it?
Hey, Steve, check this out.
Did you get it, Marcus?
Some of the students here are in their transition year, where they live in an apartment on campus before moving out on their own. They like to make some utilitarian pieces that they can cook or microwave in, and they'll mark pots with certain textures to help them identify what's what. But for Matt Mitchell, it's more about the creativity.
I just love art because I've had a lot of trouble in my life, I guess. I take blindness as a blessing, but so I think that just helps me to express kind of some of those frustrations.
Matt's classmate Mitchell Emerson wears glasses. He says the world often looks like a blurry television to him. But Mitchell says Matt inspires him.
I guess I just think, you know, for someone who can't see as well, who can't read what I can read, and how they can come up with so many things, and they can't even see that, It's just, I just think, really, I guess anyone can really come up with anything.
Maybe that's the idea behind Epic Arts. Anything is possible when community members meet on common ground.
If you can't listen to all of KC Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. And elsewhere in KCK, growing local food isn't just about health for this group of teens. Their farm fields are fertile ground for developing responsibility and shaping young lives. As KCUR intern Beth Lipoff reports, the group's leaders hope to harvest more than just tomatoes.
When you grow up in the city, chickens aren't something you see every day.
They can be a little grumpy at times. They can get very territorial.
But 13-year-old Malik Looney is getting to know them well.
They'll just flap your wings at them and start making those loud noises and that loud squawks at you, and you kind of be like, oh, no. They're mad about something.
It's early May. The teenagers of Boys Grow are here on the 12-acre farm for the first time this year. The open fields are somewhat waterlogged after heavy rain. Flats of plants started from seed stand waiting for drier weather. The chickens roam under trees and inside their tarp-covered coop. Farm manager Joshua Anderson says this is a different experience than just working on a community garden.
A lot of projects that you see with food and working with kids are usually smaller gardens. As far as I can tell, there's not a lot of commercial scale farms that are trying to start with kids.
Now in its third year, Boys Grow teaches agricultural and business skills to 12 to 14-year-old boys and aims to provide them with positive male role models. They do it by teaching the boys to grow produce. The boys then transform the produce they grow into products like ketchup, salsa, and barbecue sauce, and they become marketers of their business. Each boy has to apply for his spot and commit to working with the group for 2 years. The boys work a few times a month during school, then 3 days a week in the summertime. They all sweat in the fields, but part of the work is designing labels and talking with local businesses about carrying their products.
The underlying goal is producing entrepreneurs. So that's the ultimate goal in what we're doing. We're just taking a little unorthodox approach in doing that.
John Gordon Jr. is the founder of the project.
You know, they show up to work on time. They have to learn how to shake someone's hand properly, eye contact. A lot of the basic stuff that a lot of times you get older, you kind of take it for granted. But if, you know, if sometimes these guys aren't necessarily taught those basic skills and they're getting them at a very young age.
For this, they get paid. Gordon says that earning the money is part of the lesson.
It gets a little jingle in the pocket, but more importantly, it actually teaches them that they can make their own money and have the responsibility of having their own money. Sometimes that responsibility is in the form of a PlayStation 3, or maybe it's helping out with groceries around the house.
Some of the boys say that being in the program has helped them raise their grades at school. Another skill they learn is public speaking. Malik Looney spoke about Boys Grow in front of hundreds of people at the Soul Food Film Festival.
Right after, shortly, a lawyer walked up to me. He was like, "You are very well spoken," and he gave me a card and he said, "We'd like you to come in someday." I was like, "Okay, yeah." Boys Grow is kind of fun because you get lots of opportunities at the same time while you're doing something important.
Malik hopes to have his own farm someday. When it comes to the work, the boys divide it. One team develops the new product. The last 2 years, they've made salsa and ketchup. This year, they're adding barbecue sauce to their repertoire. 14-year-old Tariq Nash wants to become a chef. He's a member of the culinary team that created the barbecue sauce recipe.
We start mixing around a bunch of different batches to see what we like. And what we do with that is when the whole group meets, because it's not everybody on the culinary team, it's a set few of boys. So when everybody meets together, we have all our barbecue sauces together when we try those.
They started with ketchup, but the final product has more of a vinegar base than a typical Kansas City barbecue sauce. They sell their products and vegetables to local restaurants and grocery stores, such as Port Fonda and Green Acres at the Briarcliff Market. The boys also sell at farmers markets. All of that provides about 25% of Boys Grow's budget. The rest comes from grants and donations, but John Gordon hopes they will become 100% self-supporting in the future. Back on the farm, the boys know that once the hot Midwestern summer really hits, being waterlogged won't be the problem.
Yeah, try to look at the plants you're getting so you can make sure you get them all individually. Like these tomatoes here, just go over them real slow.
Joshua Anderson helps the boys finesse their agricultural skills, like watering plants.
There you go. Those are early girls. Those are really nice mid-size tomato about the size of a baseball. They're just a good all-purpose tomato. Nice. I'm getting it down, man.
Not all the farm work is fun and games. Tariq Nash's least favorite task is weeding.
You have to constantly do it or else it will take the nutrients from your direct plants. And it starts to hurt my back when I have to dig down and hoe up the weeds.
Shawnee Mission North biology teacher Ryan Ross knows the value of hard work. He's spending his summer working with the boys.
Out here, we teach them, you know, the value of responsibility and hard work because these guys have to show up every day on time, be ready to work. And, you know, middle of the summer, it's over 100 degrees out here. And, you know, we just got to teach them to persevere and stick with it.
14-year-old Stephen Banks says he's noticed a change in his own work ethic.
At first, I was lazy and really not that worried about, like, how things went and everything. When I started to get in Boys Grow, it actually made me open up my eyes to see that I need to do this and that and stop being lazy and do the right thing.
In the future, they hope to have more livestock on the farm, like goats, turkeys, and ducks, but only when the farm gets a more permanent location. And the farm is where the work really starts for these city boys like Tariq Nash.
I learned that growing vegetables, it doesn't just happen spontaneously. It takes time and dedication, and you have to really take care of the plants and show them the love that you would like show them any other living being.
For now, they're growing tomatoes, onions, broccoli, and some young entrepreneurs.
Pride, commitment, respect, Boys Grow.
For Casey Currents, I'm Beth Lipoff.
More than 20 years after being listed as an endangered species, the pallid sturgeon is just treading water in the Missouri River. Thanks to an ongoing restocking program, the fish population is stable. But as Grant Gerlach of Harvest Public Media reports, plans to improve the Missouri River ecosystem and help the pallid sturgeon recover must also take into account the broader river economy.
Hold on, guys, or sit down maybe here while we back up.
Thad Huneman, a fisheries biologist with the Nebraska Game and Parks Commission, assembles a crew of volunteers on a cold, gray April morning. There are seven of us in all in a flat-bottomed aluminum boat heading on to the Missouri River and Nebraska City to fish for pallid sturgeon. For 2 weeks each spring, Nebraska Game and Parks collects and counts pallid sturgeon as part of a basin-wide restocking program. Wild fish, old enough for spawning, are sent to hatcheries. Huneman says their offspring are put back into the river to supplement the wild pallid population.
We've stocked a total of roughly 137,000, I think, since 92, back into the river. We rarely catch the wild ones anymore, but they are still out there.
Our boat glides down the river past the fertile Iowa floodplain with fields ready for planting. On the Nebraska side, a barge loading facility serves as a reminder that the Missouri is a working river. We come to an orange buoy in the water marking an underwater trot line. This is how the sturgeon are captured. A long rope strung with hooks is anchored to the riverbed where bottom-feeding sturgeon swim. Volunteers pull in the line and unhook a few shovel-nosed sturgeon, cousins of the pallid but smaller and brown like the water. Then...
There's one. Net. Bring it slow. I'll bring the boat.
Might have one right now already.
This fish is bigger than the others. Gray scales run down its back. It's milky white underneath and has a flat pointed nose like an ancient spearhead.
That's a pallid. Yeah, you can see size difference. Pallids get much larger. We'll see. You can see how he has a little bit lighter color.
Pallid sturgeon live in the Missouri River and its tributaries like the Platte and Yellowstone, also in the lower Mississippi. Huneman says it appears pallid sturgeon are attempting to spawn in the wild, but their young don't survive. Finding a pallid born in the river is practically unheard of. George Jordan is the pallid sturgeon recovery coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
We've got a fish species that's been on this planet for thousands of years, and its ancestors literally millions of years, that within the course of a few hundred years has started to go extinct.
Jordan says the modern Missouri River works well for people, but not for pallids. Think of those two sides of the river in Nebraska City. Dams protect farm fields from all but the most extreme floods, but they also restrict spawning areas. The straightened river channel allows for barge traffic, but cuts off shallow river habitat. But reversing those changes could threaten the river economy. Randy Asbury advocates for farmers, barge operators, and utilities as executive director of the Coalition to Protect the Missouri River.
Short of there being balance between the environment and economics, there will always be a tension or a friction or even a battle that would exist in relation to any recovery efforts.
George Jordan understands economic interests loom large on the Missouri, so he's not calling for drastic changes.
I don't think the intent of the recovery program is to turn the river back to something that Lewis and Clark saw, but it's to kind of incrementally address threats to a point where it's sufficient that the species can sustain itself long term.
718.
Back on the river, volunteers measure fish and call out the numbers. That first pallid caught by Thad Huneman and his crew had an ID tag that showed it was actually born in a hatchery and released to the river in 2001. But later, they pulled in an even larger pallid with no tags.
If there's no markings on them, we assume that they're potentially wild. We'll ship them to the hatchery, and then they'll run genetics on him to confirm that he's not a hatchery fish and if he's good to go.
This spring, volunteers with Nebraska Game and Parks caught 194 pallid sturgeon. Only 22 of them had the right size and genetics for hatchery breeding. But those fish could create thousands of offspring, and for now, that's enough to save the species. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
After the break, a local coffee aficionado is heading to the World Championship of Baristas. Yes, there is such a thing. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
When it comes to coffee, Kansas City native Pete Licata has perfected the art of the quick brewing method, espresso.
Most coffee people use an S and say espresso, which is the Italian word for it.
Excuse me, I mean espresso. Licata is known as the best barista in the nation since he won the U.S. Barista Championship this year for the second time. In the competition, each barista has to mix 12 drinks in 15 minutes. This weekend, Licata is representing the United States in the World Barista Championship in Melbourne, Australia. He's competing against the top baristas from more than 50 countries. Before Pete Licata left for the championship this week, Susan stopped by Parisi Artisan Coffee in Union Station, where Licata is the quality assurance manager and espresso maker extraordinaire.
We have three different drinks that we make in the competition. So we make a single espresso, we make a single cappuccino, as well as the signature drink. I'm going to show you how we're doing all this. think of it in the way that I'll be presenting to the judges. You know, I have to tell them about the coffee that I'm serving, because it's a big element of what we're looking for in the professionalism of a barista. And basically what it is knowing what type of coffee it is, where it came from, what it's going to taste like. So the espresso that we have here in the cafe is actually a 4-bean blend of coffees. And there's 2 coffees from Brazil, and there are 2 coffees from Ethiopia. They have very different flavors, and it makes a very complex espresso flavor when we get done with it. And so they all come together. We have different types of fruit, different types of citrus. We have chocolate. We've got a lot of sweetness in there, and a decent amount of body. This is not a super heavy, you know, if we say syrupy, thick espresso. It's got a very pleasant body that's really clean. Actually, I'll pull a shot here for you and give you a taste if you like. So we're going to pull this guy out. We got to rinse through our portafilter here. It's a very simple system, even though it looks incredibly complex. And now we need to grind our coffee fresh, because fresh coffee is always better. It's always more vibrant and lively.
Oh, I can smell that.
Yeah.
It smells good.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the thing. There are a lot of aromatic compounds in coffee that are released when you grind it. Now we do a tamping method right here, which is just a little flat piece of metal with a handle that creates a flat surface for the water to interact with inside of the espresso machine.
Now, why is a flat surface important?
Well, what we're trying to do is we're trying to get that water to extract through all of the coffee grinds evenly at the same time. So now we have our flat surface. We have all of our coffee here. I'm going to rinse out our group head, make sure the water is running clean. It's nice and hot. And we're going to lock it in. We're going to start it up. And we're going to put it right into the cup. We're going to taste. And now we have an espresso ready to go. Yeah.
So what do you taste?
Well, I taste that chocolatey characteristic. That fruity blueberry type note is right in the finish. So actually now as I'm talking, I can it's coming out on the palate. And you get this just little refreshing blueberry at the very end there. A little citrus all throughout. And espresso is also a layered drink. As it extracts through that portafilter, it kind of layers in the cup. And so you have the option, you can stir it all up, and you get more of those flavors all at once, or you can keep it the way it is, and you can drink it. And as you drink it, the further down into the cup you get, the flavors will change, and you'll get different experiences the further you go down in. It's a very complicated drink, even though it's very small and very simple.
So tell me when your love affair with coffee began.
I really started enjoying coffee because of the caffeine when I was a kid, actually.
I heard you were a coffee sneaker.
A little bit, yeah. I snuck a little coffee when I was a kid. And it was mostly a delivery vehicle for sugar and caffeine.
How did you start doing it more seriously and professionally?
Well, I was studying for school when I was going to college at a cafe. And my friend was running the cafe, and I would keep drinking the coffee while I was there, but then got kind of intrigued by it, and they needed some staff members, and I decided to go ahead and take a job and work there part-time. The company that I was working for really focused on getting into the quality aspects and all of the real details that you never hear about with coffee.
Now, at these gatherings, do you ever learn any tips from other baristas that are particularly interesting to you?
Largely, there are methods that people will use to extract a coffee that you may never even dream of, because a lot of times when you're in your own country or your own city, you stick with the things that you know, and everybody sees the same things and thinks the same way. But once you see it and you understand it, it's not that alien of an idea, and you can actually start to experiment and implement things in your own way
Any funny or interesting stories, either being a barista or in competition?
There was one fellow in particular. We were in Long Beach, California, and which is kind of the West Coast with the gangster rap history. And so for the music in his little Snoop Dogg, a little Dr. Dre. So, you know, he's on stage and he has some instrumental form of Snoop Dogg playing in the background. And he had a bucket on stage and he poured an extra espresso and poured it out for his homies who couldn't be there that day.
Pete Licata is a national champion barista. He's now going to show us how he makes a competition-worthy cappuccino.
A lot of it has to do with the milk foam, or the texture of that foam that you're going to taste, little tiny bubbles in it. If you go someplace and you get these big bubbles, it looks kind of like, we always call it shower foam. You know, it's, you just shampooed and it's got these big bubbles in it. That's not considered a good texture.
Well, let's see how that's done.
Okay, let's do it. The first thing I'm going to do here, I'm going to get some milk ready. So when I pour my latte art, I'm just going to start very slow. Start filling the cup. And as we get a little over halfway, push down in and start making a design. Try not to fill it up too high. And there we go.
So how did you make that design?
Basically, you're kind of rolling and folding layers of brown and white foam together.
So can I taste this one?
Absolutely.
That's lovely. Well, thank you for being with us on KC Currents.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Pete Licata is quality assurance manager at Parisi Artisan Coffee and the winner of the 2013 National Barista Competition. Today is the last day of the World Barista Championship in Australia, where Licata is representing the United States for the last time. Licata told us that regardless of the results, he's done competing, but he still wants to coach the next generation of baristas.
We're closing this week's show with some rocking country blues. The new recording from Kansas City group Cadillac Flambé is called Movin' On. It delivers more of the Mississippi Delta sounds they've become known for. Cadillac Flambé is fronted by the husband and wife team of Christopher and Havila Bruders. This song is called Meant for Movin' On.
Some say I'm disappearing, but that's my Some say I'm disappearing, but that's my song you're hearing. Said I have a whisper, half a scream, but I'm a legend breathing steam. You didn't fool yourself and say that I'm never really gone, but it seems to me I was meant for moving on, moving on, moving on, moving on. My heart I carry riches, held profane and profound. So
that sunset to a day that's fading fast. Then it comes to realize nothing really lasts. Here's my goodbye kiss. Have I hidden in that steam? Say I won't forget. That was the American dream. Some say I'm disappearing, but that's the song you're hearing. Said a half a whisper, half a scream. I'm a legend breathing steam. Said I would fight you to the end. Just to lay my feet on these two rails. These two rails. These two rails. These two rails.
That was Meant for Moving On from a new recording by the local country blues group Cadillac Flambé.
That's it for Casey Currents this week. Check out anything you may have missed or you want to hear again on our webpage at kcur.org.
Or find us on iTunes. You can reach us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kcurrents.
Casey Currents is produced by Sylvia with associate producer Alex Smith. Our intern is Monica Sandretsky, and our theme music is by Approach. And I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.